and wait 3 hours. Then I drive down Peach's driveway. You run outside before I even have the car in park. You bounce, joy. You offer me dinner, steaks and potatoes, and then we go at it all night in one of the unrenovated bedrooms. I don't have a plan, or a backup plan, and I didn't think things through. You're a good friend, polite and loving. Of course you need your time with Peach, and I'm a serious mess, pained and bleeding. My car is in the trees, and I'm not strong enough to walk back to town and break into a B&B. I crouch and make my way back to the neighboring property. The front door is locked, go figure, and the world is lit by moonlight on snow, God bless. So I make it around back without falling and causing a ruckus. There is a boathouse, go figure, and the door is unlocked, God bless. I sneak inside and wrap myself up in a tarp. My wounds come back to life in the warmth, as if there are invisible dogs biting me, gnashing. I hurt. But rise. You miss me, and that thought lifts me above my pain. I settle into the far left corner where the wind can't nip me with such force. A cop shines a flashlight in my face. I see his gun, and I don't need a mirror to know that I look like and smell like a zombie. The cop is jacked with a thundering baritone. State your name. I cough up blood before I get my last name out. The cop pockets his piece. Progress. I sit up. Progress. He's the most American man than America ever made. Dark-skinned in a white town with white snow. He scans my Fugawi hat that he holds in his hands as if there's a barcode in the Mount Gay Rum logo. It must have fallen off while I was sleeping. He smiles. You raced in Fugawi, Spencer? A couple of times, I answer, and now I know why Stephen King can't stop writing about New England. I'm bleeding, a deer is dead, I'm squatting, my car is steaming in the woods, and this motherfucker wants to talk about sailing? He hands me my hat. Are you a friend of the Salingers? I noticed some activity there. Did you get lost? I will die if he says the name Salinger again, and I shake my head. No, I'm lost. Where are you trying to go? The questions unnerve me, and the stress intensifies my pain. Everything is wrong, and my ribs twinge. I wince. The cop is concerned. Yes. And he offers a hand. Thank you, RIPD. I take it, and I hold on. Officer, in all honesty, I don't even know where I am. My GPS crapped out a while back. I got lost. I'm a wreck.
So that is your Buick in the woods?
Yeah, I say. Fuck.
Spencer, did you have anything to drink tonight?
I'm about to ask why he's calling me Spencer, but I remember the name sewn into the hat. Spencer Hewitt. Relief.
No, sir. Did you have anything to smoke?
No, I say. But you might want to ask the deer that rammed me out of nowhere. He smiles, and I wince. He radios the station about ER wait times, and we have to get out of here now. You are close, mere footsteps away. For all I know, you're already awake, rubbing sleep out of your eyes, soothing paranoid Peach. What if she saw the cop car? What if the cop used his lights? What if he called for backup? What if you are out there right now giving a statement to the police?
I vomit all over the tarp. Let it out, Spence.
He has a comforting way.
We'll get you an ambulance soon.
But ambulances are bright and loud. I have to be strong for your sake, and I manage to get up. Not necessary, officer.
Fine, he says. But I'm taking you to the hospital.
I'll go anywhere to get away from you, and he helps me hobble outside and toward the car. The trees obscure the view of Peach's house, so even if you were standing at the great room window, you couldn't see me. Officer Nico, cool name, didn't leave his lights on. Cool dude. And his cop car is a hybrid, only an LC. And we are driving. Relief.
Nico is a good man. Friendly. Distracting me with tales of his football days at URI. He loves it out here. He's from Hartford, and he comes to life regaling me with stories about nut jobs who come up this way hoping to get a look at Taylor Swift.
As if she's gonna go out with some stalker, right?
Right, I say.
Try and get a little shut-eye, he says. We got a bit of a drive.
I admit that it's nice to have someone take care of me, someone who wants me to get enough sleep. I can relax in here. The door's locked, the heat on, the partition's solid. Soon, I am out cold, dreaming of you in an old, billowy Dickensian dress. You.
Charlton Memorial Hospital is in Fall River, Massachusetts, only 20 miles away. But 20 miles may as well be 20 light years because this place is depraved, loud, and smelly, the anti-LC. When Nico opens the car door, a wall of cigarette smoke consumes me. A dozen degenerate junkies hang around trying to score oxy. I'm tempted to ask Officer Nico why he didn't take me to the hospital where the summer people go, but what's the point? We're here. The guy ahead of us has a bloody knife protruding from his back pocket, and he's trying to tell the nurse he had an accident with a car door. A fourth grader would know that he was lying, yet he begs, "Just one oxy'll do, Sue." But Sue is tough. Get a coffee, go to a meeting, and fuck off. I'm no junkie lowlife, and Nico is pull, so we're ushered into a room right away. It turns out Nico used to work in this town, but he left because it's been chewed up, swallowed, and spit out by heroin and oxycodone. He shakes his head, and I must be glaring at the desperados in the waiting room because Sue grins at me. "What's the matter, kid?" she sneers. "Too much glamour for ya?" She cackles, and her accent is so thick that I feel bad for the words coming out of her mouth. Nico chuckles. "The kid's not from around here." Sue doesn't laugh anymore.
"No shit, Sherlock. You got a license I can give up to the gals up front?"
"No," I lie. "I got mugged."
"In the parking lot?"
"In Manhattan," I answer in my most Whit Stillman-esque voice. Sue rolls her eyes, and I'm relieved when the doctor pulls the curtain across, then back again. Exit Sue, and my physician extends a hand.
"I'm Dr. Kazakarnowski," he says. "You can call me Dr. K."
I nod, bobbing my head like a guy who sailed in for Gabi would do. "Excellent," I reply. "I'm Spencer." Dr. K prods my wounds and asks me who did this to me. "Well," I begin, "it's been a wild 24 hours. I got jumped in Manhattan. I was leaving Lincoln Center and walking, and the next thing you know, bam." I'd forgotten Nico was here, and then he speaks.
"Who was playing at Lincoln Center?"
I shrug. "We were just passing through," I say, and I wince to remind everyone that I am the patient. "Anyhow, then I left the city and hit that storm. I had an accident, a deer, and well, here we are."
"That's one old Buick you got," says Nico. "What year is it?"
I wince and signal that I need a minute to recover. Fortunately, Nico and Dr. K fall into conversation about old cars, about the warm front moving in.
"Gonna be like Indian summer," according to Sue,
who's in and out, and they do all this instead of asking what an uppity sailor like me is doing in an ancient brown beast. Dr. K tears off his gloves and tosses them in the trash. He says my ribs aren't cracked and my body wounds will heal, but my face is another story.
"Have you ever had stitches?"
he wants to know. I shake my head no. A pregnant nurse with heavy eye makeup shuffles in with two coffees and two Danishes. I can't believe my good fortune. I'm starving.
"Helen, you didn't have to do that,"
says Officer Nico as he takes the loot.
"Please," she says. "I know you don't got someone at home cooking for you. A man your size needs to eat."
So do I, but Nico chews and swallows my Danish, and the doctor holds a syringe and tells me to close my eyes. "This will hurt," he says. And when Jude Law said that to Natalie Portman in Closer, he wasn't kidding. And you aren't here to hold my hand. The shot in my forehead doesn't just hurt, it kills. Nico pats me on the back.
"Breathe, Spence, you got this."
The doctor jabs me again, this time on my cheek. I'm told to stay put and wait for the anesthetic to kick in. The pregnant nurse dilly-dallies, hot for Nico.
"So, Nico, how you doing over in Snotty Town?"
"Good enough," he laughs. "You?"
"Better if I had a nice tall, strapping cup of hot chocolate to keep me warm at night, right, Nico?"
Nico is amused, and the pregnant nurse shakes her ass as she leaves.
"Say the word, hot stuff."
Suddenly, I like it here. The way people are so blunt about what they want. Oxy, Nico's dick, coffee. And I want to be a part of things, so I whisper to Nico, "You think they got any more Danishes hanging around?" Instead of answering me, he pulls the curtain out, creating privacy. He takes out a notepad, and I wish the medicine could numb my brain. I don't like that notepad, or that pen, and it begins. I know you don't have your ID, but you want to give me your address? I make something up and I hope we're done, but we're just getting started. Nico wants to know about me. He saw the car. He saw my blood on the street. That's how he found me, and I pray the snow is melting. I pray that you and Peach stay inside. I don't want you to see my blood.
And what were you looking for? Nico asks. Did you think those people were home?
I was so out of it, I don't know.
You made a beeline for that house, Spencer. Why didn't you try the gas station up the street?
I didn't see it, I say, and why is he attacking me?
But did you really think somebody would be home?
I don't know. I don't want to do this. I want a Danish.
Do you know anyone in LC, Spencer?
I didn't even know I was in LC, I say, and it's time to up my game. I know how to work a cop. I'm gonna say what I said when I got pinned for stealing candy when I was a little punk. I swallow, and my lower lip trembles. I can act. And I stammer. Look, I don't want to get into it, and it's got nothing to do with anything, but my mom died. She just died.
He pops his pen and closes his notepad. Spencer, I'm sorry. I had no idea.
It's easy to cry because I miss you. And I still don't know how to get back to you, and you still haven't called me to tell me you miss me.
Nico gets me a Danish and I swallow it. When the doctor comes back and sews me up, I don't feel a thing. 30 minutes later, Nico and I are back in the lot and he wants to drive me to the train station. The scene out here has escalated. There's a full-on tailgating party for junkies talking about which emergency facilities are loose with their oxy. A guy in a tattered North Face jacket tries to break into a Mazda with a crowbar. Nico bellows, "Hey Teddy, a little respect?"
Teddy salutes Officer Nico, and I accept my fate. "Are you sure you don't mind?"
"No," he says. "But wait, how are you going to pay for the train?"
"Good question, officer." I pat my lower leg. "Emergency credit card stashed."
"That's good thinking, Spence. Always be prepared."
I bob my head. "Always."
Nico assures me that Leroy will tow my Buick and get her back up and running. "And he won't upcharge you either."
"You're the best, Officer Nico." And I shake his hand, firm. He drops me off at the train station, which is almost as bad as the hospital. He helps me out of his ride, and the loitering junkies scatter like roaches. I go into the station and sit. When he's gone, I walk outside. I unzip my interior jacket pocket and pull out my wallet. I can't believe they all believed my bullshit about my wallet being stolen. But then I take another look at the poor doomed souls. Of course they believed me. Look what they're up against. I walk outside and hail a cab.
"LC, please."
The driver huffs and sneers at my Fugawi hat.
"You mean Little Compton?"
"New England. All of the bitterness, most of the boating, none of the bullshit."
Chapter 32. I wake up in a different boathouse, a good half mile down the beach from Peach's home. Nico and Sue and the doctor were right about the warm front. We're in a new world now, and that storm feels like it must have been a mirage, an aberration. It really is like summer. It's amazing how good 50 and sunny feels after you've been bleeding in 12 with a wind chill of go fuck yourself. And then, even more important, nobody found me this time. I think Mother Nature is atoning for my accident, and I walk out of the boathouse, and what a relief, to not be hit with icy wind. I hunker down in the tall grass and the dunes. You and Peach are just dots on the horizon. You're both stretching. You'll go running, because you're a good houseguest. My phone is dead, which is a problem, because if you wrote to me in the middle of the night begging for me to come, I wouldn't even know. I watch you girls take off down the sand, and I run through the dunes so I can duck just in case. When I get to Peach's house, the cut on my face is throbbing again, fucking Curtis, but the back door is open, as I hoped. You're not afraid here, which is good news for me. Everything in the Salinger house is nice, and everything in my family's home back in the day was scuzzy, and this isn't even the house they live in. This is an extra. There is a whole drawer full of iPhone chargers, and I plug in my phone. I make a cup of coffee in the Keurig, and I promptly burn my tongue.
I've tracked wet sludge all over the floor, and ain't that the way? It's like the house knows I'm working class and wants me to pick up a fucking mop. I use a dish rag because, of course, they don't have paper towels. I'm sure they're saving the world. I get down and scrub, and I hate Peach. She's dominant and clingy. She was rude to disinvite Lynn and Hana. I unplug my phone, 10% charged, but still no text from you. I pocket the charger and go upstairs and find that all 6 bedrooms are in mint, clean, guest-ready condition. Peach is a seriously pathological sicko, and I'm nothing like Peach. I always give you space. Elton John hisses low everywhere because of the state-of-the-art sound system, and I can picture Peach pleading with him in a court of fandom. She begs to be his number one fan, but Sir Elton slams the gavel and sends a collections officer to seize all his music from that prissy cunt, and she has to go to work as a greeter at Walmart. But I have to say, the bedding is fucking rock star. You slept in here last night, and it smells like you. And I pick up the leggings you tossed on the floor and take in your scent. My face is calmed down in the warmth, thank God, and I wrap your leggings around my neck, tight. And I'm hard for you, and I come easily with you wrapped around me, tight. There are only 70,000 Ralph Lauren towels up in this joint, so surely the Salingers won't miss the one I use to clean up. And my coffee is still hot, and I kick back because it's comforting in here, and I deserve this. I rummage around in your duffel bag and line up your panties and bras, and I have lost myself in you, and now I am in trouble. You and Peach are back in the house, downstairs in the kitchen, kicking off your sneakers, laughing or crying, I can't tell. I can't go down the back stairs and flee because the floorboards creak under my feet. I hear your voice, and I hate old houses. They are Big Brother watching, and a guy can't move a muscle without being found out. I take 4 giant steps into the hallway, coffee still in hand, and tiptoe as softly as possible into the master bedroom that's almost directly above the kitchen. I crouch in the cedar closet just in case, and once again, I am closeted while you and Peach are free. I am sure that you are crying, not laughing, and I have to take a leak, and there's no choice. I piss in the mug. Peach must be hugging you because I hear her kicking the wall in the mudroom. An architectural staple of excessively wealthy white people. They think you need a space exclusively dedicated to taking off your fucking boots. She kicks and grunts and drones. No matter what I do, my boots get so grimy. It's like the winter wants me or something. She says she's trying to make you laugh, but you don't think she's funny. Does anyone? And she's telling you to stop crying, and you're sobbing, and I'm trying to piss quietly in a coffee cup, and Peach is not very good at soothing you, Beck. I would do better, could do better, and I want to know what's wrong. If you had reached out to me like you wanted to, I would be the one hugging you. Your crying is so loud that I feel safe leaving the closet and going to the door. Read it again, you demand. Peach sighs and reads. Dear friends of Benji, his poor mom, you whimper. Peach continues. It is with great sadness that we inform you that our son Benji is presumed dead. You interrupt. Shouldn't they be looking for him? Peach is annoyed. She reads over you. His precious beetle cat, Courage, was found wrecked just off Brant Point. As some of you know, Benji has battled addiction for some time. He recently informed friends that he was on Nantucket. That fucking tweet, you say. I know, says Peach. I hate drugs. Thank God for technology, because honestly, I'm starting to freak out. I go to the Nantucket Inquirer and Mirror website, and sure enough, there's an old picture of sober Benji in a suit alongside a picture of his destroyed boat. There are no witnesses who saw Benji on Nantucket, but his parents confirmed that he withdrew money in New Haven, and that this wouldn't be the first time that our son fell prey to his demons. The harbor master confirms the boat missing, and I confirm that I had nothing to do with this. Winter on Nantucket can be violent, apparently, and Benji's mother tells the Mirror, at least he died doing what he loves. I don't know if she's talking about heroin or sailing. I've never felt so lucky in my life. Peach blows her nose, and you're still crying, and she says the two of you should run away to Turks and Caicos, and you laugh, but she's serious. You know I've done it before. Why can't we? We pack a bag, we're gone. Even better, we don't pack a bag. You would love it there, I swear. I have school, you say, and there's a clink as she pours you a drink. Screw school, she says, a failed attempt at being sassy. I hear a zipper and she moans. Oh my God, is there anything better than getting out of sweaty Gore-Tex? Ha, you say, and you are so half-hearted and I want to hug you. I hear more kicking as the gruesome striptease continues and Peach testifies. I swear, it's like my spandex are glued to my legs. I literally have to peel them off because they itch so bad I'm gonna explode. I might throw up, and you are quiet. I hope it's cool that I'm changing right here, says Peach. Sometimes I get so sick of going upstairs to do the littlest things, and can it be any hotter? You say it's fine, and I hear her pulling the spandex off her bony body. She walks out of the room and returns, and you like what you see because you say, wow. My dad is obsessed with robes, she says, and thank God you were referring to the robes. The Ritz makes the best ones. We have a zillion in every house. You want? You want, and you take. And you opt to change in the bathroom. When you return, she gushes. How good is it in that robe? It's amazing, you say, and you are not one of those girls who call everything amazing. Peach announces that she is making kale smoothies, and she would lock you up in here and throw away the key if she could, and you don't even realize it, do you? The loud blender is my savior, and like a ninja, I fly down the hall, down the back stairwell, just for servants, that leads to the hallway between the kitchen and the great room. Fortunately, there are saloon-style doors that block this stairway, because who the hell wants to look at a servant, right? I can see it all from here. You girls are in matching giant robes, and you flop onto the couch, and put a glass of scotch and the smoothie on the lobster trap coffee table. She nudges your tiny foot with her big one. Don't be sad. I shouldn't be sad, you say. He treated me like shit. Oh, Becalicious, it's not your fault. Boys can't help it. They're intimidated by girls like us. I don't think he was ever intimidated, you say. And Peach sweeps her feet off the table and plants them on the floor. She rubs her hands together, generating some heat. You, my sweet, need a massage. You laugh, but she's serious, and she moves onto the floor and kneels and rubs your pretty little feet, and you moan. You like it. And you tell her she is good at this, and she smiles. She likes that you like it, and she continues up your legs to your calves, and I can't tell if she pulls your legs apart or if you pull your legs apart, but I know that your legs are apart, and she is working on your lower thighs, and you relax your head back, you exhale, and your arms flop to your sides. And she is getting in there, up there, moving up your thighs. You are moaning, you are. She sits up and somehow gets herself between your legs. She parts your bathrobe and your body is naked under there and your nipples are popped. And she rubs your hips and you say no, but she tells you to be quiet and you are quiet. And she kisses your left breast and holds your other breast firm, hard. You protest, but she quiets you, and you obey, and she is kissing your neck and moving one of her hands down you, and you aren't fighting her, and you aren't doing anything. You are taking it, and she is wrong. You are tipsy. Whatever she gave you hits you harder in the daylight after running, and heartsick for me and shocked over Benji, and she's supposed to be your friend. Just moments ago, you were a wreck, sobbing, and what kind of friend responds to a friend in obvious emotional distress by taking advantage of her and sucking on her earlobe? You have yet to touch her, but your body is open to her, and I don't even think you're in there right now. You're somewhere deep in your head, away, and finally, you are back. And your whole body flinches, and your legs snap, and Peach pulls back. You are on your feet, closing your robe. I'm sorry. Forget it, Peach says, and she drinks old kale smoothie right out of the pitcher. I'm gonna have a shower. Peach, wait, we should talk. Beck, please, she gripes. Did you ever think this is possibly why guys can't deal with you? I mean, just let it be. We don't have to analyze every stupid thing. She marches off with her kale smoothie, and I can tell you feel responsible, and this is not right.
You call out to her, and she responds by raising the volume on the Elton John. I hear a door slam. You cry, and how dare she lay this all on you? You pass into the kitchen. Fortunately, you don't choose the path by the servant staircase, and you return with your phone. I am shaking. This is it. Here you come. Call me, Beck. Call me. But you dial a number, and my phone doesn't vibrate. Hana, I know you're pissed at me, but I need your help. Benji's dead, and Peach is upstairs crying, and I never should have come, and I don't know what to do. Please call me. You go upstairs and pound on the door and beg her to come out and say you're sorry until your voice is raspy. She ignores you, and she is vile. She has you trapped, and you don't even know it. I push through the saloon-style doors and leave. Chapter 33. It's a shame that this beach is wasted on people like Peach. All these waterfront mansions are empty, even though it's unseasonably, gloriously warm, knock on wood. The beach couldn't be more pristine, yet none of these fucking second homeowners drive to LC to pay their respects. What idiots. I, on the other hand, am a grateful beachcomber. Yesterday, I followed the tracks you and Peach left all the way down to the jetty that reaches into the bay. This is a great place to hide, to wait. There are scattered boulders, keep off rocks, and there's a weathered wooden walkway that ends in the sand. I dug out a foxhole beneath the walkway, and I think it is warmer here than it was in either of the damn boathouses. Although, it's impossible to compare, given how cold it was the night of my accident. In any case, the sun is coming up, and it won't be long now. Soon, Peach will be here, alone. Candace would love it here. The last time I saw the sunrise on a beach, I was with her. This is no time to be thinking of Candace, but how can I not? We saw the sunrise on Brighton Beach, and as it got brighter, she tried harder and harder to break up with me. I asked her to walk down to the water with me. She did. She was cruel in that way. A nicer girl would have said no and left me to cry on my own, but she wanted to see me at my worst, so she stuck around. I am leaving you, she said. Then go, bitch, go. It wasn't my fault that Candace followed me down to the water's edge. And it wasn't my fault that I picked her up and held her down in the water and watched her pass on to the great beyond. She wanted to be there, or she wouldn't have gone down there with me. She knew she was killing me, and she knew that I was not the type to go down without a fight. I don't blame Peach for being so miserable, the same way I don't blame Candace for wanting to escape her family. What a shame to be so angered by what you don't have that you treat what you do have like it's nothing. She's not grateful to have an extra home in a place where the biggest danger is Taylor fucking Swift. She's a lot like Candace, who wasn't grateful for her voice, her talent. I have a little time, so I walk a few feet down to the shore. I like the way the water comes and erases my step. I think of that fucking poem from middle school where the dude walking on the beach isn't alone because Jesus is carrying him on his shoulders, and I smile. For years, I thought it was the other way around, that the guy in the poem was carrying Jesus, you know, the way a Hare Krishna carries his tambourine, the way a Jewish boy carries a Torah at his bar mitzvah. I didn't think of Jesus Christ as being this guy giving piggyback rides to fuck-ups, and I don't even leave one set of footprints, so take that, middle school poem. I admit, I am kind of grumpy. The last food I ate was that Danish. I cross over the walkway, built by some family with something against walking on white sand, and return to my foxhole and wait. At last, I see Peach emerge on the patio, a hot red speck in the distance. She stretches, and she trots down the walkway, and here we go. With each passing second, I can hear her more clearly, her breathing, her feet pounding, and the Elton John blasting from her phone. She passes me, swoosh. And I leap out of my foxhole like a jack-in-the-box and run after her. She doesn't hear me. She is fearless on this beach. I grab her by the ponytail. Before she can even scream, I ram her into the sand and straddle her back. She struggles, kicking, but her mouth is in the sand and Elton won't stop singing. Sitting like a princess perched in her electric chair, and I pick up the rock in my pocket. She squirms, her head to the side, and her eyes are more beautiful than I realize, and she recognizes me and she spits. You! She might be the strongest woman I have ever known, and though her last words are spoken, she's still struggling, gurgling. Her skin flares, Nantucket red, and all the exercise instilled her with a superhuman strength, a lung capacity that boggles my mind. I don't blame her for fighting. Because she was raised by bigoted, hateful monsters, she never celebrated her life, and I think this is why she musters the strength, those legs still quiver, to maximize her last moments on Earth. Her fingertips reach for my arm. It's too late, Peach. Her eyeballs sail north, toward the top of her head. And we can all learn something from an untimely, tragic death. What a danger, blaming other people for your problems. What a waste of a life. Had she disowned her cunty family and moved to one of her sunny foreign havens and been a bartender or a Pilates instructor, anything, doesn't matter, she could have settled down with a nice, like-minded girl and paid respects for all her blessings, health, brains, muscles, by being true to herself. Nonetheless, fuck her parents. Don't make a baby if you're not capable of unconditional love. She is fading, and Elton is louder than the waves. And I don't hear you anymore. We've all gone crazy lately, my friends out there rolling around the basement floor. And I owe her a little help. I hit her head with the rock and she is quiet at last. I flip her over and I'm shaking. She's gone. At peace. But what about me? Elton sings, "You almost had your hooks in me, didn't you, dear? You nearly had me roped and tied. And I feel roped and tied out here. Alone with dead, heavy Peach." Elton seems louder, or is that just because Peach is quieter? I try to focus on moving her, but then I hear a slip noose in my darkest dreams, and I pause. I panic. What if you decide to go for a run? What if Officer Nico runs on this beach? I have to move fast. I load her pockets with rocks just in case she doesn't disappear. I have to collect more rocks because this jacket has a lot of pockets, and Elton would have walked head-on into the deep end of the river. I need to calm down. I close my eyes and see Candace's open eyes in the mucky dreck of Brighton Beach, and I open my eyes, and I take Peach's phone out of the contraption band on her arm. It's my phone now, and I cut off Elton as he swears they're coming in the morning with the truck to take me home. No, they're not, and I lift her body. Peach is so clothed, and Candace was nearly naked, only wearing a little black dress over a bikini. It was summer. Drunk girls drown, it happens. Her family accepts that she is never coming home, and I walk toward the water. It is winter. Sad girls walk into the water to die. It happens. I do not keep off rocks anymore, and I carry Peach Salinger onto the jetty. The rocks are smooth and dry, and I am steady. Peach is heavy because of the rocks in her pockets, because of the weight of her misery. I count to three, and then I drop her into the ocean. The waves welcome her the way the water at Brighton Beach embraced Candace. I start an email from Peach to you. It's so easy to know what to say. "Beck, I need to go away. Lately when I run, it's like Virginia Woolf is running with me." She said, "I thought how unpleasant it is to be locked out, and I thought how it is worse, perhaps, to be locked in." She was right. It's worse to be locked in waiting for someone who isn't coming. Much worse. Enjoy the cottage. I love you, Beckalicious. Bye. Peach is. My body is slick with sweat, and my muscles ache from the exertion. And I crack a smile because I understand what Peach was talking about earlier. I'd love to peel off my clothes right now. They do itch. I check on you once before leaving. It's less than an hour since I sent you the email from Peach, and you appear to be handling it all with aplomb. You're blasting your Bowie and trying on Peach's clothes in the great room while you dance and call Lynn and Hannah and your mother and pig out. You are happy, Beck. You tell Lynn what you told your mother and what you told Hannah. This isn't my fault. Peach ran away every month in college. Hell, who wouldn't with that kind of money? Also, I think it's for the best. She seemed almost happy that Benji was dead. And yes, I know how sick that sounds. "Forget Benji," Lynn says. "It's sad, but being dead doesn't make him into a good guy. Have you talked to Joe?" go, Lynn.
No, you say, but I want to.
That is all I need. I leave. I walk up the deserted street into town. Nico's guys at the body shop are super friendly. There's not a lot going on, no shit, and they love the summer weather surprise. So my brown beast is already good to go. The repairs cost $400, and I'm glad I came prepared. New England is not a lucky place for me, Beck, so I took an advance on my salary before I headed out. The roads are clear, and Peach's phone has a lot of good music. Maybe my luck in New England is changing. I'm almost home when I remember the mug of my DNA in the cottage. I hit the brakes hard, but I don't have to worry. People with second homes get off on giving out keys to maids, carpenters, and interior designers. I'm not going to worry about a mug of dried up piss. Not after all the good I just did. Besides, this is about you, and your Twitter confirms that you're already on the way back to Bank Street. I know it will take time for you to open slowly, petal by petal, as spring opens. But you will open. Peach can't drag you down anymore. You're free. She was never going to loosen her grip on you, and you're going to be a whole new person without that pressure. She can rest now. You can relax. And when that first whiff of spring hits the air, you will pass a bookstore or a horse-drawn carriage and find yourself blushing, ripe with want. And you'll reach out to me, Joe. Chapter 34. My phone is not broken. I have called it from the shop several times a day for the past few days. You're not off the grid. You are here in New York, living, writing, and tweeting. Is there anything more romantic than new snow at night? Hashtag stillness, hashtag love. There is no logical or technological or romantic reason for the fact that you have not called me or emailed me since returning from LC. It's been 23 minutes and 13 days since Peach left the picture. The wound on my face is stubborn, but there is progress, and I'm less of a monster every day. And that's just another reminder that precious time is passing. I can't figure you out, Beck. You're not emailing with any new guys, and you're not emailing your friends about anything romantic, but you're writing about guys. The last story you wrote was about a girl, you, duh, they're always you, who goes to the doctor and learns that she has a penis stuck inside of her. She calls every guy she's ever been with to see if he's still got his penis. The list of dudes is gross long, an exaggeration it has to be, and they all still have dicks. Finally, she admits there's one dude she didn't call because he's married with children. She doesn't want to give him his dick. She wants him to leave his wife and come and get it. As Blythe said in her email critique,
there's no real ending, no climax, no point. I'm not presuming that this is based on something real in your life, but if so, maybe think of putting this story in a drawer and revisiting it once you've got some distance from your emotions.
And naturally, I am concerned. You've been seeing this Dr. Nikki twice a week since you got back. And then you write this thinly veiled story about fucking a married guy? Of course I called to schedule an appointment with him. How else can I make sure that he's not taking advantage of you? And it's not like I'm the only one concerned.
Hannah, you just went to therapy. WTF, how do you even afford this?
You,
new priorities, no boozing, no shopping, just writing, journaling, growing. Hannah, okay, Beck, but remember Dr. Nikki is Dr. Nikki.
But today is a good day, because the elevator has just hit the 12th floor and I step into the hallway and find the door to the waiting room open as Dr. Nikki said it would be. I'm a little early for my appointment, which is good because I have time to review my new identity. Name, Dan Fox, son of Paula Fox and Dan Brown. Occupation, coffee shop manager. Disorder, OCD. I know a shit ton about OCD from reading. I feel good already, and I like this waiting room, the baby blue walls and this baby blue sofa. And the building happens to be in my favorite neighborhood, the Upper West Side. Elliot saw a shrink in Hannah, and who knows? Maybe there's nothing going on between you and Dr. Nikki. Maybe he's just really good at what he does. It's possible. In just 2 weeks, you've figured out a lot about yourself. I know, because Nikki gives you homework. You have to write a letter to yourself every day, and you do. Dear Beck, you only know how to push or pull when it comes to guys. Admit it. Own it. Fix it.
Love, Beck. Dear Beck, you reel in men and you lose interest when you have them. You don't wear a bra so that guys will look at your nipples. Wear a bra. Nikki sees what you're doing. This is good. Be seen. Love, Beck. Dear Beck, intimacy terrifies you. Why are you so afraid? You can only get off when you're role-playing. Why can't you be yourself? Nikki knows you and accepts you, so will others. Love, Beck. Dear Beck, you think you can't have love until you've outgrown your daddy issues, but maybe you won't outgrow your daddy issues until you let yourself fall in love. Nikki is right. You grow through love. You don't postpone love until you stop growing. Love, Beck. Dear Beck, it's not your fault that you were born on an island. Of course you identify as an island. But dear girl, you're not an island. Be populated. Be welcoming of love. Love, Beck. Dear Beck, it's okay to resent your mom. She does envy you. Love, Beck. Dear Beck, don't be your own worst enemy and chase after guys who don't want you. Be your own best friend and learn how to love guys that do want you. And remember, nobody is perfect. Love, Beck.
These emails have really helped me get through this dry spell. Now I know that you didn't bail on me because of the sex. You bailed on me because you have problems. So maybe in a month or so, when I'm knee-deep in therapy, and I've written letters to myself, maybe I'll be in bed with you on a late Sunday morning. Maybe by then, I'll understand myself better and we'll share our therapy letters in bed. The door to the office swings open and the air smells of cucumbers, and Dr. Nikki is not what I expected. Dan Fox, he says. I manage to say hello and shake his hand. I follow him into the brutally beige office and sit down on the couch, but holy shit, Beck, Dr. Nikki Angevine is young. I assumed he'd be in his 50s, but he's for sure in his early 40s. The walls are covered with framed classic rock albums, the Rolling Stones, and Bread, Led Zeppelin and Van Morrison. He futzes around with his computer and apologizes for needing another minute, and I say it's okay. He's wearing Vans, clinging to his youth. He's a picture of restraint with his thick, wavy hair gelled into submission and encroaching blue eyes that look chock full of tears. I can't tell if he's Jewish or Italian, and he finishes up with his computer and sits in the leather chair. He picks up a glass pitcher of water. There are cucumbers in the water, thus the smell. Can I offer you a drink? He says, and once again, this is not what I expected. Sure, I say, and I take the water, and holy shit, Beck, this shit is heaven. I should let you know right off the bat, he says. I keep a notebook, but I don't take a lot of notes. I prefer to keep everything up here. He points to his head and grins. And he could be a serial killer or the nicest guy in the world, but there is no middle ground for this dude. No wonder he went into psychology. He had to find some way to stop himself from acting on twisted, perverse thoughts of his own. When he smiles, his chemically whitened teeth pop out, entirely out of place in his drawn, sad face. Well, Dan Fox, he says, let's figure out what the fuck is wrong with you, shall we? I have to say, he's really easy to talk to. I expected a doctor's office, but this is like hanging out in a middle-aged dude's college dorm room. And if we were in college, he'd leave and go to class, and then I could hack into his computer and dig up all the files about you. But that's not happening. We're adults, and he has a job to do. He wants to know who beat me up, and I tell him about the accident on my way to a ski trip, the LC crash, and I tell him about getting mugged after closing up the coffee shop, Curtis and his homeboys, and then he starts to get a little more personal and asks, "Do you have a girlfriend, Dan?" "Yeah, I could easily have one, so it's fine." I tell him I'm not here because of my girlfriend. She's terrific. I tell him I want help with my OCD. "What's your obsession?" he says. I know all about mirroring, Beck. One of the best ways to get someone to trust you is to focus on what you have in common. It's actually kind of funny, I say. All the albums you got here, I don't know how or why, but I've become psychotically obsessed with this random video by the Honey Drippers. I love the Honey Drippers, he says. Tell me it's not Sea of Love. You know it, I say, and he's my new best friend. And I'm good at this, I think. I tell him I can't stop watching the video, you, and thinking about the video, you, and wishing I could go live inside of the video, you. I tell him I've lost interest in everything because of this video, you, and I need to get some control.
Is your lady friend losing patience with you?
No, I say, because if I had a lady friend, she would be too happy to be with me to lose patience. I'm the one losing patience, Doc.
Doctor nothing, kid. And he shakes his head no. I'm not a doctor. I just have a master's.
I want to ask him why you call him Dr. Nicky if he's not an actual doctor, but I can't do that. And he says it's only fair that he tell me a bit about his own life.
What you see is what you get, Danny. I'm a 45-year-old pothead-slashed-failed bass player with a master's in psych, he tells me. I love rock and roll, and I got into this field originally because I'm a natural bullshit artist. But then I realized I actually like helping people. So here we are today.
That's cool, Nicky. And the first time I say his name, it sounds funny coming out of my mouth. A new word in my vocabulary. Nicky. I tell him it sounds good, and we talk about growing up. He's from Queens, and I'm from Bed-Stuy. It turns out therapy is just talking, and maybe you really are just trying to grow. Maybe someday I'll even be a shrink. I could do this. I could frame my favorite books on a wall in a beige room and talk to people like me, like you. Nicky says it's time to wrap things up and make a plan. Is it lame that I'm excited for homework?
Danny, we're gonna do a lot of work in here. For starters, you're gonna learn that you live in a house.
I have never lived in a house, only apartments. But I nod. And there's a mouse in your house, he says. The video. And the good news is that it's just a mouse. And now you're a mouse, Beck. It's not strong like you, Danny. He's very serious now. That mouse is tiny. You've got arms, hands. You have dexterity. You only have a pussy, and I agree with him. You can reach the doorknob, Dan. You can lay down traps. Traps. You know, Danny, life's a bitch, and sometimes it gets dark in your house. He points to his head, and I nod. It does get pretty dark in here. And that's when the mice come. You came into my store and started this thing, us. Sometimes it gets so dark that all you can do is listen to that fucking mouse scramble around and eat your food and shit on your floor, and it's so dark that you can't see the doorknob, he goes on. You forget there is a doorknob, and what we do in here is we turn on the lights, Danny.
Right.
We set the traps, Danny.
Right,
I say, louder than before. And we open the door, and we get the broom, and we shoo that mouse out of there, he says, and he punches the air. And sometimes, we don't even need to do that because sometimes we kill that mouse. Not this time. And it doesn't happen in a heartbeat, I'm not gonna lie, Danny, but it's doable. You ever work in construction, I ask? Most guys in our neighborhood did at some point, and I like the idea of Nicky and I having stuff in common, being equals. Couple of summers back in the day, he answers, and I was right. You? Couple of summers back in the day, I say, too eager. What a loser, and a copycat. But Nicky smiles, and I think of the past few weeks and the nights I spent on the floor against the wall with your panties in my hands, staring at the hole in the wall that I made because of you, and covered because of you. Yeah, doctor. He shakes his head and I laugh. I mean, Nicky, I need to find the doorknob. You're gonna find it. And if the house/mouse concept doesn't work for you, you can also think of the video as a zit. You can pop it and it's gone. Forever, no scars if you take care of your skin. You are not a zit. You are a mouse, and I speak. I thought you weren't supposed to pop zits.
That's bullshit, he says, and he looks at the clock.
So, do you like Thursdays? Afterward, when I walk down the street, I feel like a changed person, Beck. 50 minutes with Nicky, and it's like I have a new set of eyes. The world looks different to me, like I put on 3D glasses, or smoked a joint, or fucked the shit out of you. I feel high, but straight. And I head for the park where I watched the Sea of Love video for the first time in a long time. The girl in the video is kind of cute with the Bowie blonde hair, and therapy is working out already.
I mean, watching this offbeat, trippy video makes me happy, and I haven't been happy in a while. And the best part is that I'm not afraid anymore.
You're not sleeping with Nikki. You're just experiencing transference.
I know about it from the Prince of Tides. It happens. Nikki has a master's, and Nikki is the man, and he'd never break the doctor-patient dynamic.
It applies, even though he's not a real doctor. I walk to the subway and then walk down the stairs.
I like life, Beck. I feel all this new patience. I can wait for you to call me. I am strong enough to give you time.
I forgot to check your email, and your phone is heavier than it was this morning. I write to myself, even though he didn't tell me to. Dear Joe, you have a mouse in your house, and when she's ready, you will kiss her and she will turn into the girl of your dreams. Be patient. Be open. Best, Dan Fox. I haven't felt this close to you in 2 weeks. I love therapy. I do.
Chapter 35. At my next session, I told Nikki about how I feel high when I leave his beige office. He said my reaction is common. I'm normal. And it's all about a new perspective. I have a place upstate, he said. I get out there into the woods every couple of weeks, not because of the fresh air, but because of the fresh perspective. In my third session, we talk all about the video, you, and Nikki tells me about what he calls the cat strategy. I used to have this neighbor who rented her cat out. You know why? To help depressed people, I ask. Wrong. If anyone in the neighborhood had a mouse problem, Mrs. Robinson would lend her cat for a day or two, he says. And Danny, the thing about mice, if they so much as smell a cat, they're out of there. So if I started watching something else, I'd stop watching the video? He nods. We don't talk. Sometimes that happens in here, an abrupt silence. Nikki says it's normal. You have to process things. I process the idea of a life without you. I date other girls, unimaginable, and go on walks, and maybe I'd find people to play basketball with or sit in a dark bar watching the news and fall asleep in my bed without your phone in my hand and wake up without your phone pressing into my flesh. My hands hurt from obsessively checking your email. Maybe it would be nice to have fingers that don't sting. I don't know what it would be like to be here without you inside of me, Beck. I do know that you were a lot to handle. I'm tired. Nikki can sense when I'm done processing. He readjusts in his chair. Give it a shot this week, he says. Journal on it, and let me know how it goes. I like having homework, and I leave his office and find that the world is full of women. So maybe I do want to find out about life without you. I'd almost forgotten about girls. They're everywhere, Beck. On the subway platform, there are college girls in tight jeans with their heads buried in Kindles, and round old chicks hanging on to reusable bags of vegetables, and middle-aged housewives heaving with raggedy bags from Macy's and Forever 21. And there's a hot blonde chick who's so little she makes you seem like a Jolly Green Giant, and she's in scrubs. And she looks freshly scrubbed, and I'm totally fucking staring, and she smiles. Game on. Do I know you? She says, and she has a little bit of an accent. Long Island City, I think. No, I say, and she walks toward me, not away from me, and she smells like ham sandwiches and rubbing alcohol. I like her tits. You don't know me at all? Sorry, no. Then why the fuck are you staring at me? I don't know, I say, and I wonder what Nikki would say. I guess I must just like staring at you.
The train screeches to a stop, and her electric green beady little eyes home in on me. And random women go onto the subway as random women get off, and the two of us lock eyes like animals in heat. She has thin eyebrows and long painted fingernails, nothing like yours, which is good. I could never love this girl, but I sure can practice on her. She starts.
Who kicked your ass?
I had an accident.
You had an accident, she sneers. That's a good one.
I got jumped.
So you just fucking lie about it before you even know my name?
I guess I just felt like lying.
and I am good at this, and Nikki would be impressed. Well, what if I don't go out with liars? Then it sucks to be you. What the fuck is happening right now? You know, who cares? I say, and I am on like Donkey Kong. If this conversation were happening in a dark bar and we were both shit-faced, it would be perfectly normal. Her name is Karen Minty, and she bites her glossy lip and gets in my face. And if your grandmother had balls, she'd be your grandfather. Karen Minty decides right there that she's gonna have sex with me, and I know it. She's so much easier to read than you are, and I couldn't ask for a better cat, and it starts with an obligatory drink at some fuckface bar packed with NYU kids who drink American beer out of buckets. You'd hate it here, but she loves this place. This bar was her choice, so now it's my choice, and I take her to a hole on Houston that I know will impress her. I was right, she is from Long Island City. And she is impressed by Botanica Bar, and she drinks Greyhounds and says shit you would never say, like, "Do you know how I know about this drink? Leonardo DiCaprio drinks these, it's true. Do you know why food in hospitals sucks my ass? Because they do want you to die. It's true, Joey, it's true. It's fucking cheaper, and not as many people have to work doubles if you got more empty beds. Do you know that I had this feeling like I was gonna meet someone tonight? I shouldn't be fucking saying this, fucking Greyhounds, but Joe, I had this fucking feeling, and then you were staring at me," she burps. "That needs to come off, Joe." "My shirt?" "That bandage on your hand. I forgot it was there. Look what you did to me. It started when I burnt my hand in the candle. Then the healing was interrupted because I picked at the scab because of what you did to me. Then Curtis beat me up while I was rushing to get ready to go see you, and then of course I crashed my car while I was looking for you. I see a pattern here, and Nikki says life is all about patterns, and now Karen Minty grabs my hand like it belongs to her. Karen Minty is fucking strong, and she whispers in my ear, "Save your energy, Joey. You're gonna need it." She yanks the bandage off my hand, and before I can wince, she kisses me. As it turns out, Karen Minty's lips are strong, too. My hand doesn't hurt anymore. By the time we get on a train, I don't think either of us knows which way the train is going. It's a miracle that the train is empty, not even the random bum or gangster or hoe. It's a miracle that Karen Minty licks the place on my face where Curtis fucked me up, and her tongue is sharper than yours, and I fucking tear off her scrubs. She's wearing a thong. And she grabs at me, and we go at it on the fucking subway at 4 in the morning. And when Karen Minty comes, she screams, "Yeah, Joe, yeah, I'm yours. Come now, now." And she digs her claws into my back, and her eyes roll around in her head. And when she finishes, her legs are still wrapped around me, vibrating. I hold on to her tight, wishing she were you. She sticks that pointy tongue down my throat, and she takes it back, and she looks at me. "I love you," she says. And what have I done? And she bursts out laughing and hops off of me and wraps herself in my coat.
"Your face, Joey, oh my God, you should see your fucking face right now. I'm just fucking with you."
"I know," I say, "and I will not worry. Most girls go fucking insane for a few minutes after they fuck. That's just the way it is." She is defensive.
"Obviously, I don't even know you."
"I know," I say, and she curls into me, not away from me, and I look at us in the window. We come and go as the lights flicker in the tunnel, and I will sleep tonight for the first time in a long time, and Karen Minty will make me an egg sandwich and give me a blowjob in the morning. I can just tell. Something about those Greyhounds, something about that mouth. She does love me. I am the best patient ever, because already, I have found a stray cat. The next day, I get to the shop and I'm hungover as all fuck and full of an egg sandwich that was a bad idea. Karen Minty meant well, but Karen Minty was probably still too drunk to cook. I told her it was a nice time. She told me she'd come by the shop. I didn't encourage her, Beck. And now I have Ethan up my ass. He's early again, and he wants to know if I'm sick.
"Do you have a cold, Joe? Or did you just have too much sauce?"
Only Ethan calls it sauce, and I unlock the door, and if I were a therapist like Nikki, I wouldn't have to deal with Ethan. I send him to fiction to find staff picks, and I turn on the music.
Karma is a bitch. The first song that comes on is You Are Too Beautiful from Hannah and Her Sisters. I slam it off. Suddenly it hits me. I cheated on you. I cheated on us. My head pounds. The doorbell chimes and every noise hurts, especially the one that comes now, the girl I just banged. Karen fucking Minty. I want to slit my wrists. But at the same time, I'm dying for coffee and she's holding two hot cups, Starbucks, surprising, and she shrugs.
I didn't know how you guys take them, so I just got fucking everything.
She plants a heavy paper bag on the counter. Ethan comes bounding to the front of the shop, and she is scary friendly to him right off the bat.
You must be Ethan, right? Joe told me all about you,